All my skills got formed in my late 20s, and I was ready to go at age 30. Luke Uther would show up. And
Rick Springfield on the Iris session. You show up because they need you to play mandolin.
Jeff Porcaro called me and said, I want you to be the guitar player. I played on so many Celine Dion records.
With Phil Collins. I'm just trying to get inside your head.
All right, first of all, thank you so much for watching the show, subscribing, all of it. Second of all, for my guitar players out there, we just launched a Patreon that's got some awesome, awesome stuff in it. So check it out in the pinned comment below. There's a link. All right, on with the show.
And Tim, thanks so much for taking the time.
You too, man. I've watched a lot of your episodes. They're great. Yeah, and okay, so I'm putting the pieces together. You are quite a guitar player. You are a professional guitar player, but you're doing something different now, much like me.
Yes. Yeah.
Were you saying that you played the Wicked show? Was that what I caught in Greg's?
I did do that for a while. Yeah, I was in the pit of it on Broadway, which was quite a thrill.
I bet. I bet it was very demanding. Greg Wells used to hire me from time to time, and I've enjoyed his talent for decades. And it's just great to see him. Yeah, you know, doing so well. He's such an amazing musician.
Have you ever met, he said in that interview, which I thought was so funny, he goes, I don't mean to be cocky, but I think I'm the only guy on the planet who could do this, meaning play the drums, guitars, bass, keys, everything, plus arrange, plus mix. Do you know anyone else in the session community that has that skill set the way he does?
There are people who hide some of those skills. George Deering is our preeminent motion picture guitar player, and he can play bass and sing and play piano, and he's an otherworldly multi-instrumentalist on stringed instruments too. There are a few, but most people hide it. And as you know, Rick Beato can play everything except the drums. There are very few. And in the session world, it wasn't so much that guy who would get hired, it was the specialists. Now Steve Lukather can play piano great, and he played drums and bass on his original demos when he was a teenager. So there's a lot of people who have that stuff. But the thing about Greg is that he literally can sit down on the drums and sound like Vinnie Caliuta. And then he can sit down on the piano and sound like a virtuoso. And when he picks up the guitar, you know, he's right. He gets right to Eric Clapton immediately, you know. So there are very few. And the thing about when Greg does his rhythm section where he plays all the instruments, and I even noticed this on the Wicked soundtrack when I listened to it, it sounds like Elton John's band from the 70s. So it sounds real. You know what I'm saying? Like the drums on Wicked sound real. They sound like, you know, it's...
That's what blew my mind about it. And he says it too. He's like, I'm not phoning this in. And I go, you're right, Greg. It sounds so believable.
Yeah. So to answer your question, there's almost nobody. I mean, you know, guys like Prince could play every instrument, but at Greg's level, I don't think so. I can't think of anybody who can make it sound real, you know?
Tim, you have said on multiple occasions that one of your favorite records is Wichita Lineman. What do you love about it? It is the favorite record for Tim Pierce. What do you love about that recording?
I'm so glad you asked. I grew up in the 60s. I was born in 58. And my love of music comes purely from top 40 radio. You know, the kind of radio you would hear out of a speaker that was about the size of a quarter. Okay. There were some better speakers. And then when FM showed up, it got better. But that era where I would hear in cars and on transistor radios, top 40 music, I fell in love with it. I mean, it would transport me to another world. It literally would, you know, I'd be in the stratosphere when I would hear songs on the radio. And that song in particular, it's so romantic and it's so haunting. And it's this unrequited desire, unfulfilled desire, just perfectly executed. And the end with the orchestra, the way it fades out and the chord changes and Glenn's voice, all the elements. I mean, I hesitate to even define it because defining it reduces the impact of it, but it is my favorite record of all time. It's this beautiful, sweet combination of the plaintive singing, the beautiful lyrics, the chord changes that are unusual but perfect and beautiful, and then the orchestra with the rhythm section and that outro that you just want to last forever.
What are the takeaways from it if you were to go in and study it? It's all the things you say, but is it sometimes you can put a baritone solo in the third verse, or what are the things that should really be taken away from it?
Well, even from the beginning, it's that pulse that comes from the instrument that they brought in. It's a special instrument. I forget the name of it. And then it's also the flat wounds on the baritone, right? So I'm getting it right there. And then Glenn's voice, which is, it's just, it sounds like a very young, innocent man, which I did Glenn Campbell Records. You know, he went through the whole cycle of being a rock star and all the problems associated with that. But, you know, he sounds like a very innocent young man. And then the chord changes, there are key changes and modulations within the writing that are just gorgeous and unpredictable. And then I've heard all the solo instruments. There's a beautiful finger-picked guitar part. And then, you know, the actual song was unfinished. Jimmy Webb sent it to Glenn and Al DeLore, and they just finished it by adding that melody in the third verse with the baritone. So, and then you go to the end, and it's the orchestra. And I can't think of the name of that keyboard, but they brought in the special keyboard that made the Morse code sound. So those are some of the elements that I can, you know, identify that I love.
Tim, you have said, and maybe this is a little bit in jest, but you have said, thank God that Tom Bukovac never moved to LA because he would have taken too much work. And similar to that, I've spoken to Dan Huff, who said that when he moved to LA, there was a real hole in the session scene because Steve Lukather was on tour with Toto. So there was a real hole that he was able to fill. Was one musician really able to have that much of an impact on the scene back then?
I'm so glad you asked, because I experienced that phenomenon, and I was the up and coming version of a studio player. I was still collecting my studio skills at that moment when Dan showed up, and I was pretty good at some things, getting better at other things. And then by 1990, I started working every day in the studio because I really got my skill level up. But these other guys were finished already. They got out of, like, Steve Lukather was finished at 18, and Dan Huff was finished by the time he got here. So the way I understand it, and I think this is all pretty accurate, Robbie Buchanan, who's a really dear friend of mine, phenomenal keyboard player who I worked with a lot, he experienced Dan's talent in Nashville on a record. And he told Dan, come on out, I'll hook you up. And he did. And so he recommended Dan. And Dan had everything it took to immediately jump in. And you're absolutely right. Lukather was not so interested in session work because they were blowing up and doing amazing. You know, there's a lot of responsibility in being in that band. And then Luke would do the Quincy sessions and a lot of other high profile stuff like that. But he wasn't doing the day-to-day work. So you're right. There was an absence. Now, there is no absence unless the guy who shows up is the most talented guy in the world. And Dan was just, he was that guy. He could cover everybody's sounds and parts. He could do the R&B thing beautifully. I sat next to him and watched him extrapolate R&B parts that were beautiful and musical and perfect instantly. And then he could do the rock thing. He could, you know, you would hear a thing, you go, oh, that Mike Lando played a great solo. No, it was Dan Huff. So he really was, you know, he was just so hardworking and ambitious and so talented. And he did displace the entire list of guitar players. Now, that didn't mean there, I mean, I starting in 1990, I started working all the time, but that was the point where Dan started to lose interest in LA sessions and wanted to, you know, have the band giant. So it actually kind of worked well for me by the time I got my skill level up and my experience up, because I wasn't formed at age 20. All my skills got formed in my late 20s, and I was ready to go at age 30. So I started all that a little later. But when he left, Michael Thompson was the busiest session guitar player. And that's only because Mike Landau decided to do less. Mike Landau has always been selective. He was selective in the 80s, the 90s. He's always been that guy. And so that left more open slots, but Michael Thompson was the guy at that point, and I was able to become another guy and start working all the time. So,
but the impression of the golden age is that there was just so much work, and it's almost funny that one person, because they can only be one in one session at a time, would people just say, we'll wait for them versus calling someone else who was probably amazing also? Like, one person really controlled the scene that way? Or is that sort of a little bit of a fantasy looking back on it?
Well, you're just ahead of home studios for guitar players. So at that, and in that era, the keyboard players, a lot of them had their racks at home and they had 24-track analog machines at home. You remember, we're still in front of Pro Tools. We're still ahead of, this is still analog most of the time. So the digital thing is beginning. When I built my ADAT studio and then my Pro Tools studio, I was able, it was the greatest thing for my work in the history of my work, because I was able to never lose a session because of scheduling. When I built my studio, and I'll come around to your question in a second, but I'm kind of going to the side of it. When I built my studio, I was able to say to people, I can see you on Thursday morning. I can see you Saturday at 11. I can see you Tuesday at 2. Because guitar overdubs, which I ended up specializing at, I liked orchestrating. I liked getting my work done after the bass player and drummer. I enjoyed tracking, but most of the value I could give was in the orchestration of layering guitar parts after all that was done. And that could be done anytime in the process. People were relaxed enough. You know, they would schedule the tracking dates. Those were etched in stone. But after that, everything could just unfold as it needed to. So I never lost work after that. After having my home studio, I never lost a session because of scheduling, because I was literally like a doctor. I can see you at 10 on Thursday. I can see you 2 on Tuesday. So, but prior to that, just prior to that, when guitar players did not have home studios, you are absolutely right. Dan Huff would get the call. If he wasn't available, they would, if he was essential to the work, they might try and move the session so that they could get Jeff Porcaro on drums and Dan Huff on guitar and, you know, whoever on bass, Neil Steubenhaus. And if they could find that slot, they would get everybody at the same time. If they couldn't, they would just sacrifice somebody. And then Michael Thompson would be next in line. Michael Lando might be next. I might be fourth in line. You know, it's, I walked into a jingle session once, and it's a really renowned jazz bass player named Dave Carpenter. And the jingle producer was a friend of mine. He said, man, I tried 12 different bass players. I couldn't get anybody. And then Dave Carpenter walks in bright and shiny, so happy that he got the session. And I'm sure that happened to me on a daily basis too. But yeah, because of scheduling, you know, that was the reality of it. And also, you know, somebody like Dan, they would get as much of him as they could. So, you know, if you booked Dan Huff for 6 hours, he might be halfway done at the end of hour six, but he couldn't come back for 2 weeks. So he was out of there. And then I might get the call because they, you know, they needed more and he was gone, you know, so there was that too.
Right. When you moved to LA, you say this, that you feel like you had great lead chops, but your rhythm chops needed to develop. How did you sit in on these sessions early on and feel confident or not insecure in your abilities? Or maybe you were insecure. And how did you escape? To me, I get so afraid of going into sessions and not having the right skill set. And it seems like you felt that way too. So how did you get over that when you were starting out?
Well, I never really got over that, but I was quiet, and there's a strength in kind of keeping your mouth shut and just taking everything in. I had a lot of advantages. I kid you not. When I moved to LA in 1980, it was a very nurturing environment for musicians. So, and particularly as a guitar player, I mean, the drummer was always in the hot seat because we were recording analog. The drums had to get nailed, okay? But everybody else, and particularly guitar players, they wanted guitar players to be kind of, you know, and especially when Nirvana showed up and that changing of the guard happened, that's when I really started working it, because I could be the guy who sounded, I was reliable enough to get all the parts done, get the sounds done, but I sounded like I could be a band guy. So they wanted guitar players to throw surprises, and you did not have to be perfect as a guitar player. So that's one thing that helped. You did not necessarily have to be the best reader to be a guitar player, and that's another thing that helped. And then I would ask for help. If I was in the room with Greg Phil and Gaines, I would go, Greg, how do I play through that chord? Show me that passage. What's that line? I mean, I would just ask for help. So that's one thing. But you're just managing fear at that point. I think a lot of people deal with that all the time. And even some of the guitar players that we know that are, you wouldn't think would feel those insecurities, feel them going into a session. I felt them very severely, especially when I was going in with Nathan East and Greg Filling Gaines and John Robinson. You know, my stomach would literally be sick, but I would show up there, ask for help, you know, and my part didn't have to be perfect. Their parts were perfect the first time and mine wasn't, but they, you know, they accepted you. It was okay. So as guitar players, we were forgiven for, you know, playing catch up, you know, and not being the best readers. Now, that being said, you never on a TV film date represent yourself as being a reader when you're not, because those guys, you know this, you were one of those guys, you show up and you read. And if you read it again, it's only a matter of interpretation because you get it the first time. The first time it's beautiful, but maybe they want to do this part a little more rubato or whatever. And so that I learned that really, really early. You know, I sat in, I took a couple of orchestra sessions because I was brave. And it was like sitting there with 90 pieces when you're the guy who doesn't exactly read, it was like, nah, I'll leave this to.
So what would you do? Would you just completely flub those sessions or how would you get through them?
You get lucky. I got lucky a couple of times and then I realized I didn't want to just roll those dice anymore. You know, I just got lucky a couple of times and was able to get through.
Why would I don't understand. I've heard this from other session players of your stature that when they arrived, like the other guard or the older guard would help them on the sessions. And to me, that almost doesn't make any sense because wasn't this so competitive? Did they see something in you where they would want to help you? Why do you think the other guitar player might help you along?
I think it was a tradition that started with Tommy Tedesco. And, you know, Lukather would show up and he had enormous skills, but maybe he couldn't read a passage. There's an amazing story that Tommy Tedesco, you know, Chuck Rainey was trying to read a bass part and couldn't read it. And he told Chuck, he said, lay out. And nobody noticed because it was a big, you know, ensemble. So everybody helped everybody. Because what you want in the session is you want everybody to win. There is no gain in, you know, you see somebody who is vulnerable and it's not going to help you or the music or the producer to tear that person down. It's only going to help you and the session and the music or the producer to have everybody pull their weight. And then what happens then is, you know, you don't get called for those sessions after that. You get identified as somebody who's not ready. And I'm sure that happened to me a lot. I just persevered to an extreme level and I waited for the environment to get a little more, well, the environment shifted. Like I said, in 1993, I think it was when Nirvana showed up, the environment shifted to where I was the perfect studio musician because I was the guy who could sound a little less polished, a little more like a band guy, but I could reliably deliver all the parts by then. And so I just waited for music to get simpler and I got involved with some crews that were, you know, doing the work. And so it's just perseverance and time that brought me into the fold. But that being said, I would avoid the sessions that I knew I wasn't right for. And most of those were the reading sessions.
And then how did you spend the rest of your time during the 80s? You were on the tour with on the road with Rick Springfield. Was that a good move or a bad move in terms of furthering your session career?
Well, I realized early on that it would kill my session career. But I didn't have much of a session career at that point, so it wasn't that big of a liability. But I knew by the end of my last Rick Springfield tour, I started turning down all tours. And the first one was with Joe Cocker. I did a record with Joe Cocker with Chris Lord-Alge and Roger Davies, and it went really, really well. And they asked me to go on the road. And I said no, and they offered me more money. And I said no, and they offered me more money. And I said no again, and then they chose somebody else. And that summer, I regretted it greatly because I didn't have much work, but I was beginning to do demos and sessions, and I was beginning to build those connections that lead to other connections. Because you would do a session, any session with anybody, it might have been a demo, and the engineer or the artist or the studio owner would take notice, and it would lead to another session. And so the thing would just start rising. And I remember something happened to me. I did a short tour with Al Jarreau, and I always loved Al Jarreau because I wanted to be that guy. So that was another real reach. I kind of was a little underqualified for that, but I did it. 10-day tour with Al Jarreau, and Jeff Porcaro called me and said, I want you to be the guitar player on my first production. I'm producing Boss Gags, and I want you to play guitar on it. And I couldn't do it because I was on the road, and it broke my heart. And because Jeff and I, you know, I'll wrap this up, but Jeff, I created a friendship with Jeff Porcaro because he came super early to every session because he lived in Hidden Hills. He wanted to beat the traffic and just show up and relax. I came early to every session because I was scared to death and I wanted to make sure my gear was working and wasn't buzzing. So for an 11 a.m. session in Hollywood, he and I would be the only two people in the room at 9 a.m. and we would start jamming. And we became friends from showing up early before sessions. And so it was at that moment that I realized I am never going to go on the road again. And even I did a Phil Collins record that was just so great. The first day I worked with him and he asked me to go on the road, at that moment I just laughed. It's like, this is what I do, not that, you know.
Anything that you could take away that you could tell a drummer about Jeff Porcaro's playing that to just do or pay attention to? Or was he just such a natural and did just come so easily to him, did it seem like?
Well, everybody had their voice at that point. And even to this day, if you solo a Matt Chamberlain drum track or a Victor Indrizzo drum track or a Vinnie Caliuta drum track, Aaron Sterling, what you hear is unique and individual and crazy. You hear things that you don't hear in the full production because they disappeared. All these little clocks going, all these extra little ghost notes. It's amazing. And Jeff had his own version of that. But Jeff knew that, and this even happened one night. So Jeff was elegant, understated, played for the song, didn't do too many takes, and had a beautiful feel. Okay. It was like fine wine. Okay. But he also knew that sometimes there were other drummers who were better for the session. And then indeed, one night I was doing a film date, and it was one that I could read because the composer was on my side and a friend of mine. And Jeff was scheduled for the date, and driving back to Hidden Hills, he called Benny and said, "You got to do this for me. I'm tired. I worked all day with Herb Alpert." And so, unannounced, Vinnie Caliuta shows up 5 minutes before the downbeat. And the composer's going, "Well, I can't really complain. I was expecting Jeff to show up, but okay." And Vinnie, of course, aced it. But Jeff actually, if he got called for a certain kind of music, he would recommend John Robinson or Vinnie instead. If he felt like Jeff really, really wanted to be comfortable and speak his language. What I'm trying to say is he was the icon. He was the fine wine. But he also knew that he was part of a collective of, you know, at that time there were five or six guys. Mike Baird was one of them too. He doesn't get talked about a lot. There were a lot of records in the 80s where half the record was Mike Baird and half the record was Jeff Porcaro. So he knew that he was surrounded by his buddies who could do it also and do. They were all so unique. You would think that drums wouldn't be that way, but you know as well as I do, you solo a drummer's track and everybody's so unique. And Jeff was unique.
Right. Wait, so you guys, the two of you guys would be in these sessions before anyone else, and you would do what? You would just play like a funk chord, like an E9 or what?
I'd start warming up and he'd start, you know, it's like, I'd be like two chords, three chords, whatever, an outro. It'd be like the vamp to, you know, we'd just do vamps forever. I'd be playing, you know, yeah, funk, rock, whatever came out of my guitar, whatever beat he was playing. I would play to his beat or he would play to my guitar part. That was awesome. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
Wait, and he meant something to you at that time, or like, did he feel like a peer, or did he feel a little bit in a class above?
Well, both. I spent my whole career feeling that way, you know, because I never had, my only training was 2 years. So every once a week for a half hour for 2 years from age 12 to 14, I would take a guitar lesson from a guy named Steve Mays in Albuquerque. So if we add up those half hours, that's 26 hours. That's 52 hours over 2 years is my entire musical training. I had no training. And every session I showed up in, there were university, you know, graduate level, you know, conservatory level people all around me. And so I never felt like it was an equal, but I did work. I knew that I played from the heart and I knew I would try really hard and I knew I was there for a reason. So I dealt with it. But yeah, I felt... But part of the pleasure of being in the room with Phil Collins or Jeff Porcaro or any of the artists I worked with is you go, okay, I was in Albuquerque looking at this name on a vinyl record going, this is my favorite song I've ever heard. That's my favorite artist. And now I'm in a room with that person. So there is an insecure side to it, but there's an actual dream come true side to it too, right? So, you know, it was a dream come true. I couldn't believe I was sitting there with Jeff jamming, you know, and then he would recommend me for stuff after that. And like I said, he was going to do his Boss Skaggs record, his first production as a producer. And I couldn't do it because I was on the road with Giroux. So, you know, he valued what I did enough to ask me to do that. But he, you know, he's just a sweet guy.
To put a bind on Rick Springfield, you did Live Aid with him.
Yeah.
On the American side. Anything notable about that gig, or did it just feel like another day on the road with Rick?
Okay, so, we would do that kind of stuff in the 80s that was really big stuff, but we didn't know it was big. So that was, okay, so it was everything. I have a great story about it. So Rick, we stuffed it in between two other gigs. We were on the road, okay? And we went on, I think, right after the Beastie Boys in the morning, right? And it went great, but we all felt pretty intimidated. And the funny thing was the way these situations work sometimes, and I had this happen with the Eagles one night too, when I was doing a show with Linda Ronstadt opening with the Eagles. My stage pass was only valid until about 3 p.m. So you get this feeling like, oh, I'm not really welcome here because, you know, there's a hierarchy, you know, and as the day wore on, the artists got bigger. And then, well, who was it? You two and George Michael and Phil, I forget, you know, whatever. So it was amazing. 80,000 people. The show went great. It was 11 in the morning. We were on, we were off, but we were in the middle of the tour. So for us, it was just, you know, another big gig. And Rick Springfield, when I joined the band, he was the biggest star in America for two reasons. He had Jesse's Girl and he had the TV show, General Hospital. Now that Live Aid was maybe 3 years later and that had plateaued a little bit, but we were still doing huge venues all the time. And I knew he was more of a pop star than a, you know, perceived more as a pop star than someone like Peter Gabriel or Genesis or like that. But, you know, we were very proud of what we did. And so it just was one day in the life, but it was a bit disappointing. Now, the same thing happened to me with the Eagles on New Year's Eve in the year 2000. I was in Linda Ronstadt's band. We opened for Jackson Browne and Jackson Browne opened for the Eagles. And because my photographed stage pass, like I had a photograph of me on my credentials, right? But because I didn't have the yellow dot.
That yellow dot.
I was banished from the venue somewhere around halfway through Jackson Browne's set. Okay. So I had to tell the LAPD officer at the backstage a story just to go get my guitar so I could leave. What saved us is Patty and I knew a gentleman who had been on tour with Rick Springfield named Dave Cavelli, and he was the stage manager for Staples Center. And he brought us a couple of passes. And I remember Irving Azoff's people looking at us like, what are they doing here? What are they, you know, we were sitting on the side of the stage on an anvil case and they walked by looking at us like, we're not supposed to be here. These are show business realities that, you know, it's just, you have to laugh. You just have to laugh.
Wait,
one more. Can I get you? Yeah. Can I tell you one more?
Go.
So, you know, I've done a bunch of records with Phil Collins. So I always get invited to Phil Collins concerts. So we went to one and we went backstage and we were in a level of backstage that's three away from the real backstage. Like there was our backstage full of people like looking around going, who's that person? Who is where? And, you know, and there's a bar and everything. Well, then there was another backstage and then there's the real backstage. So decisions are made. They look at a list of people and they go, well, we can have, you know, five people in the room with, you know, the real people. And then we can have another 25 in this other area. That's the green room. And then we'll put the other 200 in the room that's far away, which was where I was. I'm looking up there. Somewhere up there is the real backstage. And the irony of it is that 2 days later, you go, oh, Phil was disappointed. You didn't come say hi to him.
That's always how it goes, right?
I'm so used to it. It's
Wait,
amazing.
Did we capture it? You said there was a great Live Aid story. Did we capture it, or was the point
that was it? Yeah,
you couldn't
that was
get
it.
Back. The passes were constantly changing. It was.
Well, I was my first take on that because you go into this thinking, oh, we're all part of Live Aid. You know, we're gonna, you know, but then you realize you actually they want, you know, they want to make space. They don't want, you know, the riffraff to be.
Right.
I mean, it was one of my first, it was the first time that happened to me. It was like, oh, I didn't know that even existed. I didn't know that, you know, we were at a kind of a level where we were not wanted backstage after 3 p.m.
You did the most brilliant thing on a session once, and I'm trying to understand. I'm just trying to get inside your head because this is so not how I would operate in this setting. But on the Iris setting for the session for the Goo Goo Dolls, they said to you, we need someone to play mandolin. So show up with a mandolin, and you show up with your racks of gear and guitars, and they were annoyed. They said, what is going on here? But you knew if there's even a chance that I'm going to be able to play electric guitar, I want to have all my stuff there. But I would be the opposite because I would be thinking, oh, they just need mandolin, so I'm going to make this so easy. I'm just going to show up with a mandolin, play that down. How did, like, was that just what you always did, or how did you have that foresight?
You know, we all have our ambitions and our, you know, our way of trying to excel or rule the world if we can. And I just didn't want, I had this vision of me walking in with this tiny case, and that was not the vision I wanted. I wanted the vision of the cartage truck pulling off. So, I made that choice, and I did only find out later that they were annoyed, but the producer, Rob Cavallo, was not annoyed. And that was the first day of a 20-year run. Well, it's a run that still lasts that I work with Rob Cavallo. So I took a gamble. Now, and on that song, I got to do a guitar solo. So it worked out exactly as I had hoped because, you know, Rob just looked at Johnny and said, well, he's here, the gear's here. Let's, you know. Rob was really intrigued by all the gear. And then the other thing he was intrigued by is that I wrote a chart. You know, musicians do this all the time, but Rob was used to working with Green Day, and he was a Warner Brothers executive, and he was used to working with bands, and he hadn't done that much work with studio musicians. And I did a takedown in front of him in one take of the song. And I even did some, you know, there were maybe some chords that were slash chords, you know, like, you know, C major 7 over A or whatever as an example. And he was like, wow, I've never seen this before. And so he was open. He saw the rig, he saw the amps, he saw the guitars. He said, let's hear what this guy can do. I mean, he was just going to erase it or whatever. I was there, and I played this slide guitar solo, and it stuck. You know, so that was best case scenario. Now, later, that began to work against me. Probably, I did a session for Mike Shipley. You remember Mike Shipley? He mixed all the stuff for Mutt Lange. He's an amazing guy. I started to bring all my gear in, and he started to get more and more angry. He just wanted one amp and one guitar. And so there was an era, and it almost happened all at once, where people decided they didn't want the guitar player to have a big rig. It was maybe in the late 90s, and we don't want to see a rack. We don't want to see a bunch of stuff. Just show up, get set up quick, and go to work. So it did flip at a certain point, but the gamble paid off. You know, you gamble. You roll the dice.
Didn't you do a Tom Petty session once where Mike Campbell just ripped your cord out of the guitar and said, we're not going through any of this, and he plugged you directly into the amp?
Yeah, I was playing through my rack, and smoke was coming out of his ears behind the console, and he came out, and he unplugged me from the rack, plugged me into my matchless, listened to my sound. He said, there, that's your sound.
And was he right? Was it a better sound?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I have this theory that everyone who's so obsessed with the digital modelers today, I think we're going to go back to analog pedals if we're not already, because I think people forget that that actually sounds better than all the digital modeling stuff at the end of the day. Did the racks, do you think they sounded better, or actually going direct in, is that what actually sounds best?
Well, I would go to your Dan Huff interview where, you know, the thing about that era is there were two sounds in the 80s that the studio guitar player provided. One was the stereo clean delay chorus sound, and the other was the stereo delay saturated lead sound, power sound. And these worked well over tracks that had a lot of keyboards. But the other thing, and this might sound negative, during a tracking session, the idea is for everybody to high-five each other and go, we just made the record, which is really not, a lot of the best records were made, you know, with layering and overdubbing later. But the problem with guitar on a tracking date is if you have a mono guitar through a little Fender amp, right, it's not going to sound like you just finished the record in front of the client, the producer, the artist, or whatever. So the stereo guitar sound that they would fill the monitors with these delays, gave the artist and the producer and the engineer confidence that you had finished the record, even though maybe you hadn't finished the record. But it was just, it was a bit of an illusion and a way to go, yeah, see, look how full it sounds. We're done with the guitars. And it worked because, you know, you listen to those old Chicago records, whatever, and, you know, they bring up the powers. And then Umberto Gatica would just replace one side, so you would get a double track guitar. The minute you double track a guitar, you have the record. But, you know, you weren't going to take the time to do that on the tracking date all the time. So that was the guitar sound in the 80s. Now, like I said, when Nirvana showed up, the reason I started working all the time is that I struggled to get a good rack sound through the 80s. By the time I finally got a great rack sound, it had become kind of passe. So racks ended up sounding great. Landau always had a great sounding one. Huff had a great sounding one. Luke had a great sounding one. But it was generally never the in-between sounds. It was never the edge of breakup sounds. It was this totally clean thing or this totally distorted thing. And so then Landau and, this is so fun to talk about, Landau and Michael Thompson got smart and they started bringing their own mic pres. So you would take your vintage Vox AC30, you'd put the microphones in front of it, it would go through your mic pre, through all your effects, and you have this beautiful edge of breakup sound with all the stereo effects, and the engineer would just throw up the faders. I did that too. That was it got to that point right before it ended. And it was amazing because you would use your vintage amp and make it whatever you wanted with the effects being used as they're supposed to be used, which is after the mic pre. So, but I, in 1993, like when this change of the guard happened, I was already very adept. Like the reason Pat Leonard hired me for Toy Matinee is I showed up with amp heads and just played. I sounded like a British guy from the 70s. So back to your question, we go full circle here. You feel like the digital modelers, it's a funny thing because there is a barrier of entry because of money for guitar players that gets solved by these, you know, the Tonex at 199 or even, you know, whatever level you get up to with these modelers, and they sound pretty good. Now, Tom Bukovec is not wrong when he says, when you hear those, you've just forgotten what an amp really sounds like. And that's true. I play through amps 99% of the time, but I do like the sound of an in-your-face modeler for some parts. And I even had, like, Matt Serletic showed up here once, and he brought his Kemper, or we used my Kemper maybe, and he used it because to him it sounded modern at that moment. So an artificial guitar sound can sound compelling and modern, and it can be in your face in a way that works in a track. So it's just a tool to use. I don't know, Zach. I still use amps 99% of the time. I enjoy the artificial sounds as a tool and a fun thing to mess around with. You could be right.
So going back to just put a button on it, on the Iris session, you show up because they needed you to play mandolin, and you bang that mandolin part out, and then they say, well, what if we take a solo? They're looking at all your gear, and they say,
it's Rob.
Rob was looking at all your gear, yeah, and he said, well, maybe we should try something else. You go, bingo. That's why I brought all this shit. That was the point.
Yeah, and I even was I was playing a game, too, because the reason I played slide is I thought, if I play slide, then, because I could sense that, you know, I was an outsider in this situation. If I play slide, then I'm not going to play any guitar licks because I can barely play. It's going to be like a one note melody if I play slide. I'm no slide, you know. So that was actually why I did that, because I thought, okay, this will keep me from playing you know, a blues lick. So it even that was somewhat like, you know, how do I survive this? I mean, part of it was like, I did 15 years of records with Trevor Horn, and Trevor was so objective that myself and Jamie Mahoborak, Jamie worked with him a lot more than I did, but with Trevor, you would try and create a part that he didn't erase 2 weeks later, because he was so objective and he would listen so many times that, and part of that is making a part that's kind of becomes transparent and doesn't, it becomes part of the orchestra. And so this was a version of that. I didn't want to be a guitar player playing licks. So I picked up my slide and I knew that it would have a better chance of sticking because I would play simpler. Now, the other part of that story is the reason I was there the night before, they asked Dean Parks to do, but he had worked all day and he was just driving home. And he said, I'll come back. You know, no, he didn't say he'd come back. He was booked the next day. He couldn't come back. They wanted him to come back and just drop it in that night, but he was too tired. And so I got the call the next day.
Do you see any international royalties from that song?
Yes. Okay. So the way it works for musicians from the era that I have been part of is, well, there were two royalty systems set up, the collective bargaining royalty system set up that still exist for movie sessions and record sessions. So there was that, but it was never based on playing on a hit. Because I had friends who played on Alanis Morissette's first record and they go, well, yeah, my special payments, what's it going to be like? And it was like, dude, it's based on all the sessions you do. So the royalties that the record company give back are based on how many sessions you do. It doesn't matter how popular those songs were. There's that. So we had those royalties. They still exist. The guys in Nashville get them, you know. Then there are the SAG-AFTRA royalties that everybody gets now too. But we've had those forever. But those are... The way that Iris paid and still does is that players, performers have neighboring rights. You may know all this. They're called neighboring rights. And the biggest agency that collects for me is called PPL. And then I have a separate one in Italy that does better, that's independent. And I have another one in Canada that does it. And then we have the AFTRA one too. But these entities collect performance royalties from every country in the world except for the United States, Syria, North Korea, and I think there might be one other. You know this. And so if Iris gets played in Europe all year long or in Africa or in, you know, Japan or whatever, I get, you know, it becomes part of this aggregate of royalties. But I played on so many Celine Dion records that that's a big part of it too. You know, it's everything adds up. So it is part of the this neighboring rights we all get as musicians.
Okay, wait, to stick with the narrative with Rob Cavallo, so he then calls you for the You'll Be In My Heart session with Phil Collins.
Well, that was later.
Later.
That session, that Iris session, you know, that song, he called me then to play on the Goo Goo Dolls record after that, and then he started calling me for every single thing he did. And part of it was that song... You know, Iris was like the biggest airplay song in the world for like 18 months. And for him, that was a real turning point. And because that was a song on a movie soundtrack, we started doing soundtrack songs for every time an artist had a soundtrack song, Rob would get the call and we would get to play on it. So I started doing every Cavallo session, and it did eventually lead to You'll Be In My Heart, because Rob was really great at, he's a really good guitar player and a really good musician and a really enthusiastic record producer. So he was busy all the time, and he became very loyal. He was actually my biggest client and my most loyal client. And now he's a friend.
He said in an interview I watched with you and him, he said that they were trying to figure out how to put that together. And then he said, you know what? Just play this like Kiss. Pretend this is a Kiss record. And that is such a funny note to me when you listen to the song. But do you remember when he said that? And what did that mean to you? How did that impact what you played on the record?
Well, he just meant make it sound like a rock band. And they had, I think they had actually kind of cracked that code early on, because he told Phil early on, let's try this. Let's make this sound like a Rolling Stones song, you know? And so they had actually cracked that code, but by the time we were in the studio, it had morphed into something else, and they had, I think, forgotten. So we spent a few hours trying to get it off the ground. And the, when you, you know, decode what he was saying, he was just playing, he was saying, let's play rock, basically. And when we did, they put up this particular drum loop, and we just, you know, don't, you know. And we just started rocking, and Phil was like, yeah, that's it. So we got stuck for a few hours. But then once he made that comment, and, you know, you interpret it, and you go, he just means let's play rock.
Right.
Let's get free. Yeah.
Okay, we're running out of time here. I want to try like a small game. I don't know if this is going to work, but we're going to try it. I want to name a session guitar player, and I would love to know if you were on a session with this player, or even if you were on a session, what your role would have been to complement their playing.
Please.
So if you were doing a session with Dean Parks back in the 80s or 90s, what do you think your role would have been to complement what he was doing?
Okay, so I've done over 100 sessions with him, maybe 200, I don't know, countless. And he is, I am the band guy, and he is the solve every problem on acoustic and electric and read every part guy. So I let him have his space, and I play band guitar parts around it. And I'll make these answers short.
Yeah. Okay, what about Mike Landau?
Mike Landau, he was always so nice to me. He brought me into a Faith Hill session, and I sat next to him. And I just tried to play a glassy part because his parts are so huge sounding. And I played the U2 part above his massive, you know, girth part.
Okay, what about Steve Lukather?
Lukather, I did get to work with, and it was the same story. Luke was on fire when I worked with him, and I had a little more size to my part, but I do remember playing the reliable eighth guitar part while he was the rock star who played the amazing solo and everything else.
Okay, what about Dan Huff as a peer in the guitar player chair and also as a producer?
Okay, it's great to have both of those questions to answer. When I would sit next to Dan Huff, I identified myself more as the new wave band guy, and then he would be, you know, he would be the all parts immediately guy. You know, I would just let him shine with his brilliance and learn a lot. You know, you're learning a lot. When we did Rascal Flatts in Santa Barbara, and he was the producer, I was in heaven because I got used to working. When you work with a guitar player as a producer, there's nothing more heavenly, nothing better, because they solve every problem for you. They go, it's a little too clean, a little dirty. Try this. You know, they get you out of every dark corner. You know, it's amazing. And he said to me, he said, you know, Tim, you know, a lot of guys freeze up when they work for me. And I just started laughing at him. I said, ain't going to happen.
Why not? Why? Because he felt like a peer, or why do you not freeze up around him?
By that point, it was the late 90s. I had enough experience that I knew it was just going to be a joy. And I knew I could cover it. And indeed, at a certain point, he said to me, he said, you know, if you wanted to move to Nashville, and this is during that session, if you wanted to move to Nashville, all you would have to do is tweak what you do just a little bit, and you'd fit right in. And I said, dude, it's okay. I'm covered here. I'm dug in. I'll stay here. I'll ride this out. But it was a really nice compliment. The great thing about that session is that because he couldn't go home at night, we had dinner and hung out every night. You understand, if somebody's in Nashville, they're going to go home and see their family in the evening. But because they were on the road and we were all in the same hotel together, we all got to hang out after the sessions every night. It was so fun. It was great.
That's a great record, too. I love that Rascal Flatts record. How would your parts balance with Joe Don Rooney's? Like, would you guys work together, or was he even on those sessions?
Oh, absolutely. He played, and even within the Howard Benson version that I did, and I did another Rascal Flatts at Howard Benson first, and he was on that one. Then you get into the role where I'm the polished guy playing the, you know, covering all the intricate parts, and Joe is the band guy. So the role shifted. So it's even to say, like, when I work with Luke and Huff and Dean Parks, I'm basically Joe Don. And then when Joe Don worked with me, I was as good as I could be at those guys. And then Joe Don was me.
Tim Pierce, we are wrapping up here. I think we've all spent way too many hours watching your videos on YouTube. Maybe not enough hours, honestly. The master course is out for Tim Pierce. If you're watching this and you're not subscribed, go sign up for Tim's master course. It's all on his website. Subscribe to his YouTube channel. Have we left anything out, Tim? I mean, I could have gone for another hour, but what's been unsaid?
We could do it again. We'll do another hour sometime, man. Have me back. But because it's really exciting and fun to talk about all this stuff. The masterclass is, it's almost 2,000 videos and almost 200 hours of lessons and content. And it's a subscription, and we have thousands of members, and there's a 14-day free trial, so you can try it and see if you like it. But that's my focus these days. And I love doing it. I love the new world we're in, and can't thank you enough for this interview.
Tim, back at you, and hopefully I'll see you in person. Are you going to be at NAMM?
Oh, yeah. Are you?
I'm on the fence. I think I'm going to come. I always usually go, but it's so chaotic. I think I'm going to come. I don't know.
It's getting better. It was kind of on fire last year. It's even going to be more on fire. And the reason it is that people really value it purely for the social aspect. And I think if you came, you would have so much fun, you wouldn't even believe it.
Okay.
I really do.
That's a good recommendation from Tim. Tim, I so appreciate taking the time at the end of the year during the holiday break. I really appreciate it.
Me too.
And I hope we get to do it again. Thank you so much.
I do too, man. Take care.